This is KGNU's Morning Magazine for Friday, May 21st. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, Colorado Senate passes a bill to expand labor protections for agricultural workers. A safe encampment site for homeless people in Denver's Park Hill neighborhood will remain after a district court judge dismissed a lawsuit that sought to shut it down. We'll hear from a conservative conservation group on what it's like to split from the typical position of the right and instead call for oil and gas leasing reform and work to dispel oil and gas industry myths. Then at 9:30, it's the Morning Sound Alternative, when you can get your weekend started off right with music until noon today. But first, we'll start with the headlines. In COVID news, late yesterday, Boulder County Public Health amended its face covering order, effective immediately through June 10th. The amendment requires individuals to continue to wear masks indoors, regardless of vaccination status, in schools, childcare, and healthcare settings, on public transportation, including ride shares, and congregate care facilities in Boulder. This differs from the state mask order, which will be lifted for all indoor facilities beginning June 1st. And be aware that businesses can still implement their own policies and require you to wear a mask. In regard to vaccinations, the state announced Thursday that approximately 11% of Colorado kids between the ages of 12 and 15 have been vaccinated as part of the state's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Governor Jared Polis said all of the state's community vaccination sites offer the Pfizer vaccine for kids that age, and most do not require an appointment. But he added that anyone under the age of 18 would need parental consent before getting their shots. As far as adults, Polis said two-thirds of Coloradans over the age of 30 have received at least one dose of the COVID vaccine. Speaking to KBUT in Gunnison earlier this week, the governor was asked about the effect of politics on mask wearing.
Politics should really not have a place when it comes to a health issue. This is about keeping yourself healthy and safe, preventing loss of life. Colorado's lost 6,500 people to this virus, just over that number. And the virus doesn't discriminate. It doesn't care if you're black or white or conservative or liberal or far right or far left. It's taken people in their prime from all walks of life. And the smart thing to do is to get vaccinated. I've had COVID and I've been vaccinated. I can tell you having COVID is much worse than getting vaccinated. Getting vaccinated, you might have a sore arm the next day, just like the flu shot. You might be a little under weather the next day. It's really no big deal compared to COVID.
On another topic, Governor Jared Polis said Thursday he will issue additional pardons to Coloradans convicted of low-level marijuana possession crimes now that he signed a bill into law allowing people to have up to 2 ounces of cannabis. House Bill 1090, which Polis signed on Thursday, doubles Colorado's recreational marijuana possession limit to 2 ounces for adults 21 and older. He said some people who were arrested prior to the state's legalization of marijuana could have drug charges on their record, noting it would disproportionately be people of color, and that could impact their ability to obtain loans, leases, licenses, jobs, mortgages, and many other things. Polis added that his office would begin reviewing records over the next few months in preparation for additional pardons. At Meade High School in Weld County, officials are investigating a photo shared on Snapchat of what appears to be three students reenacting the murder of George Floyd in the school parking lot. KGNU's Steve Miller has more on the incident and how school officials are responding.
The Snapchat photo came with the caption, "Bidding Goodbye to Seniors." The Daily Camera reports that St. Vrain Valley School Superintendent Dan Haddad strongly condemned the reenactment made by a group of students from Meade High School. Haddad added that racism in any form can have a deep and lasting impact, and the district will be addressing this extremely serious matter immediately and accordingly. He encouraged parents whose students need support after seeing the photo to reach out to a school counselor. On Wednesday, Meade High School principal Rachel Ayers sent an email about the incident to parents saying the behavior doesn't represent the values of the school and an investigation has begun. Current and former students of Meade High School, along with parents and community members, signed a petition on the social media website change.org to denounce the photo and demand consequences for the students involved. By Thursday morning, more than 4,000 signatures had been collected. I'm Steve Miller for KGNU.
Boulder police are conducting an investigation after a bicyclist was struck and killed by a vehicle on South Boulder Road yesterday around 3 p.m. Investigators have not released the identity of the cyclist. Officers at the scene said it appeared the cyclist rode directly into traffic near Manhattan Drive before being hit. Three zero-emission electric buses are now operating on Boulder's Hop Route. The city says the new buses, designed and manufactured by Proterra, are 100% electric and emission-free and charged with renewable solar energy. The zero-emission electric buses are quieter than diesel buses, more fuel-efficient, and can travel more than 200 miles on a single charge. On that note, if you're traveling this week, know that the Colorado Department of Transportation will close Interstate 70 this weekend for a historic traffic shift in the heart of Denver. Also known as the Mile High Shift, the traffic shift will close eastbound and westbound I-70 between Washington Street and I-270 starting tonight at 10 p.m. until Monday, May 24th at 5 a.m. Once closed, a press release from CDOT said it will move all six lanes of Interstate 70 traffic from the existing viaduct to the future westbound lanes of I-70 in the lowered section of the project and eventually demolish the structurally deficient 57-year-old viaduct and build the future eastbound lanes of I-70. Today's forecast along the Front Range, high near 80 degrees with a low tonight around 50. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy skies and a high of 74, and the same temperature for Sunday, but with a promise of sunny skies. Right now, outside our Boulder studios, it's 54 degrees. A bill to create labor protections for agricultural workers in Colorado has passed the state Senate. SB 87 would eliminate carve-outs that have exempted farm owners and operators from having to pay a minimum wage or overtime to those who work for them. Supporters of the bill staged a day of lobbying and then a rally on the steps of the state capitol yesterday as SB 87 passed out of the Senate and moved to the House. Next up are voices from that rally, starting with bill co-sponsor, State Senator Jesse Danielson.
My name is Jesse Danielson. I serve in the state Senate. I represent Jefferson County. Unlike almost every other worker in the state, agricultural workers are not guaranteed the minimum wage. They are not guaranteed overtime protection, and they cannot organize to advocate for themselves. This bill takes care of all of those things and guarantees ag workers for the first time in the state of Colorado the right to organize, the right to overtime protection, and the right to earn the minimum wage. But because the ag industry has been carved out and excluded from these basic guarantees for workers, there are some other problems that they face too. A lot of people work in employer-provided housing, so they live on their employer's land. And because of that, oftentimes they are barred from receiving critical services like medical visits, clothing, food, PPE during the pandemic. And they're also barred from visitors. Keep in mind, this is their home, okay? So we put in protections into the bill to take care of that too. We've also put into the law shade, food, water breaks, and rest breaks, because some of you might not know it, well, not some of you, but some people across the state do not know that ag workers also aren't guaranteed those basic rights. And these are people who labor in extreme heat, extreme cold for sometimes 80, 90 hours a week, and they're not guaranteed a rest break. Well, we took care of that too. So that's in the bill. And one very important piece that we have in this bill affects this industry worker in a way that is unlike other workers. I have seen a sense of fear in these workers, a fear of retaliation and retribution from their employers, unlike any other worker I've ever worked with. And I've been doing workers' rights legislation for 7 years, ever since I got elected to the State House. So what did we do in this bill? We wrote right into it a protection from retaliation. So the folks in the Senate today who voted yes to pass the bill out of the state Senate voted to give these workers the same basic human rights that almost every single worker in the state already enjoys. The right to the minimum wage, the right to earn overtime, the right to organize, to stand up for themselves and advocate basic food and water breaks, protection and access to their homes, and protection from retribution. And I am proud to say that I voted alongside the majority of the state Senate to finally make sure that the state of Colorado no longer condones this kind of legal exploitation.
Me llamo Juana Armijo, y he estado en los Estados Unidos desde el 2002.
Good afternoon. My name is Juana Armijo. I've been in the U.S. since 2002. I'm the mother of six kids, three of which have been deported, one of which has died in an accident. All 17 of my grandkids are born here, and I have a U.S. citizen husband who I care for, who's debilitated from diabetes.
Trabajé por 5 or 6 years. Como trabajadora agrícola en Colorado y Arizona.
For 5 and 6 years, I've been working in the agriculture industry in Colorado and Arizona. I have worked in all types of vegetable and flower operations, including roses. All the places that I have been in, the conditions are horrible. They have stolen our wages. We work Saturday to Sunday without any breaks.
Experimentando explotaciones. En cada uno de los lugares.
I have suffered exploitation in every single one of these places. Wage theft, sexual harassment. They have fired me for going to a medical clinic. They wouldn't give us water. There aren't any bathrooms to use. They told me to go in the river and buy the corn stalks. There's no water to wash our hands or to take off the pesticides from our hands to eat.
Nos mostraron un video contando las consecuencias de los pesticidas.
They showed us a video of the consequences of the pesticides, the side effects, the fact that it can give us cancer. We had to sign a paper saying that we understood that we accept all these consequences and that the farm has no responsibilities. And they wouldn't give us gloves nor PPE to protect ourselves. Now we're going to go on to Farmer Damian Thompson from Frontline Farming. Give it up for Damian.
I'm Damian Thompson. I'm a descendant of Bantu-speaking people from Western and Southern Africa. I'm a descendant of sharecroppers from South Carolina. I'm a descendant of generational farmers from the state of North Carolina. As this bill for agricultural workers' rights has moved through the legislative process, industry opponents have advanced the narrative about the unique nature of Colorado agriculture as a means to defend exemptions that they have enjoyed for the better part of 85 years. They point to the length of our growing season. They point to Colorado's unpredictable weather patterns and the inconsistent nature of our agricultural economics as indicators for the need of a different set of rules than those that other employers in other industries have to abide by. This narrative was even advanced by the opponents of the bill on the Senate floor during yesterday's debate. This narrative, and this is important, is both historically inaccurate and intellectually dishonest. Despite the stories of happy workers dancing, right, or magnanimous employers, it is the history and legacy of structural racism and white supremacy that underpins the exemptions that agriculture enjoys. And despite the efforts of the agriculture industry to create false equivalencies between itself and other industries, in truth, with the exception of the prison industrial complex, there have been very few industries whose economic foundations have consistently been underscored by the systematic abuse of Black and brown people. That's what's up. One of the tools of this oppressive relationship in Colorado has been the short-handled hoe, and I want to thank Paul Lopez for bringing his grandfather's short-handled hoe from northern Colorado. For almost 50 years, the short-handled hoe has been prohibited in California. It's prohibited in Texas and in other states. After California prohibited the use of the short-handled hoe, back injuries among farm workers decreased by 34%, even as workers continue to do the same type of physically demanding work that they had always done. Farmers and agricultural industry leaders attempt to distract from the injurious nature of the short-handled hoe by emphasizing its quote-unquote traditional use, right? Traditional use, they tell us what's traditional for us to use. On contemporary farms, hired laborers, mostly from vulnerable, undocumented Black and brown communities are made to engage in this debilitating, degrading stoop labor until their backs give out. This narrative about happy workers, this narrative about the economic system, we will not accept that story. We will not allow people to sit in boardrooms and tell lies about the people from whom we are descended.
That was Damian Thompson of Frontline Farming. Before him was agricultural worker Juan Armijo. At the top of the segment was State Senator Jesse Danielson, co-sponsor of SB 87, a bill to bring labor protections for Colorado farm workers in line with those of other sectors. You are listening to KGNU's Morning Magazine. Denver District Judge Bruce Jones on Wednesday dismissed a lawsuit meant to block the creation of a legal homeless encampment in Denver's Park Hill neighborhood. Proponents of creating secure, fully staffed outdoor encampments for homeless people in Denver say they plan to move forward with projects in Park Hill and at Regis University. Eric Galatas has more.
A Denver District Court judge dismissed a lawsuit meant to block efforts to create a legal homeless encampment in Denver's Park Hill neighborhood, but the project could face continued pushback from some residents. Cole Chandler with the Colorado Village Collaborative, the group behind the site, sees safe outdoor spaces where residents can wash their hands, access bathrooms, and connect with mental health and other supports as a necessary stopgap measure.
The pandemic created a significant need and an opportunity for cities all across the country to respond to this need that's bursting at the seams in new and innovative and creative ways.
The shortage of affordable housing units has reached 7 million nationally, and each night more than 580,000 Americans experience homelessness. In 2020, more people were sleeping outdoors than in shelters for the first time. Opponents of the Park Hill camp, planned for a church parking lot, claimed the site posed a danger to children, didn't meet city requirements, and failed to address the impact it will have on the neighborhood. Many Denver residents have become uncomfortable with the number of tents popping up in residential areas, but Chandler says sites such as the one planned for Park Hill create a better alternative for those forced to sleep outdoors. The encampments are fenced and staffed 24/7 with a single point of entry where residents must ring a doorbell to be let in. Chandler points to his group's first site on Capitol Hill as proof that camps can be safe for residents, staff, and the broader community.
Since we opened our site, we've had no complaints from neighbors. We've had zero calls for police service to our site, and we've had zero increase in criminal activity in the area.
Since the first camp opened in December, residents secured more than 180 appointments for medical, mental, and dental care, along with employment and housing navigation. Chandler says 12 residents have gotten jobs, 7 have graduated into long-term housing, and 5 others have secured housing vouchers and are looking for placement. This is Eric Galatas reporting for the Colorado News Connection.
Conservatives for Responsible Stewardship is a national nonprofit organization founded on the premise that environmental stewardship and national resource conservation are inherently conservative. KGNU's Hannah Lee Myers spoke with the president of CRS, Dave Jenkins, about their calls for oil and gas leasing reform and work to dispel oil and gas industry myths in a political climate where being conservative and a conservationist seems like a split from the status quo of the right.
First of all, we don't believe taxpayers have been getting a fair return. A lot of the laws that govern oil and gas leasing today are 40 years old or even older. So, like, for example, the minimum price for bidding on acreage is $2 an acre. But most states that do the same kind of oil and gas leasing on state lands, they're charging much more than that, you know, $6, $8 an acre. So what that does, it leads to a lot of speculative leasing where these lands are getting locked up ostensibly for oil and gas production when actually they really have very little chance of ever producing. And in the meantime, all the other uses for that property, outdoor recreation, tourism, water supply, hunting and fishing, all the other things that these lands could be managed for, they're not getting managed for those purposes. They're just sort of sitting on a shelf for potential oil and gas drilling. And then you look at the royalty rates that we get off of production on public lands, it's less than what we are charging for production offshore. So that doesn't make any sense either. Compounding this for taxpayers is the whole orphan well problem. When these companies go out of business, sometimes they go out of business and then pop back up as a different corporation to get out of obligations for cleaning up abandoned oil and gas wells or once orphan wells once they've been tapped out. And so that burden is falling more and more on taxpayers as well. And it's really not fair.
And one thing that Conservatives for Responsible Stewardship has tried to draw attention to are some of the myths and misinformation spread by the oil and gas industry. Can you tell us a little bit about some of those that you've seen and what work you've done to combat them?
Yes. Well, I guess the biggest one is the claim that this pause that the current administration has done, the President Biden did, pausing oil and gas leasing, is somehow going to make us more reliant on foreign oil, or it's going to raise oil prices, gas prices for people and stuff like that. And they're just making stuff up because, first of all, this pause does not affect existing oil and gas leases or existing oil and gas production. So there's that. But then beyond that, the oil companies have stockpiled over 4,000 leases that they're not currently doing activity on. And, you know, the CEO of Devon Energy, CEO of Occidental, they've all said that, hey, we have enough stockpiled leases to last us more than the Biden term. And so we don't expect to have any impact whatsoever from this pause, whether it's 6 months or longer. So for them to say that and to acknowledge the truth, and then, you know, once the pause is enacted, for other players in the oil and gas industry to say, oh my gosh, the sky's falling, it's just disingenuous. And, you know, if we've got a bad system where taxpayers are getting the short end of the stick, then what we want to do is actually do that. Pause and try to get some reforms enacted that will rectify that situation before we start leasing back up. Because if we were still leasing while we were trying to get the reforms passed, anything that we lease currently would be under the old rules, and therefore taxpayers would still be getting a raw deal.
And I'm curious if you have any thoughts on what's been going on in Colorado when it comes to oil and gas.
Well, one thing that comes to mind is that, you know, Colorado sort of led the country in instituting stronger standards on methane releases on state lands, like oil and gas companies, you know, when they're producing natural gas, they do the flaring and they'd have a lot of times they have leaks of methane that are causing pollution and climate issues. And when the federal, you know, we've tried to get this passed at the federal level, and it actually did pass back under Obama and then was rolled back during the past administration. You have all these people claiming that, well, if you tighten up these methane restrictions, it's going to provide an impediment to drilling and to that kind of activity. And actually what we saw with the Colorado law is actually it had no adverse impact on drilling activity. The drilling was just as attractive under the stronger standards to the oil industry as it would have been under the looser standards. So it sort of proves the point that these kind of standards are smart business practices and good business, and that the bigger oil players are trying to do that anyway. And, you know, it's an example for the rest of the country that we can have strong standards and it doesn't adversely affect the attractiveness of oil and gas operations for the companies.
We've been seeing a lot of talk, especially recently, about splintering amongst conservatives and looking at what's going on with Representative Cheney. And I'm curious what it's like to be president of Conservatives for Responsible Stewardship, kind of straddling the fence of things that have been associated a long time with liberalism, you know, versus conservatives and conservation being an issue like that.
Yeah. Well, you would actually be extremely surprised, I would expect, that I go around and I give presentations to local Republican clubs. And so when we're talking to local Republican clubs, we're talking like, you know, the base. We bring these messages about being smart on energy and following the current market, which has changed a lot lately, and, you know, what we need to be doing on climate and how conservatives have to be engaged on climate or all the solutions are going to be coming from the left. And the response is amazing. I mean, so many people are so thrilled about that message and about how they can get engaged because, you know, stewardship is supposed to be a conservative value. I mean, you know, you can look through history and you'll see from Teddy Roosevelt to even Ronald Reagan and the Montreal Protocol or Richard Nixon and with all the environmental problems in the late 60s and early 70s, you know, doing the right thing in terms of conservation and stewardship has historically been a conservative value. So to the degree that some people in the party seem to have lost track of that message, it's extremely frustrating. You know, one thing conservatives have always done is believe in the market, believe in capitalism, and following the market. And with respect to oil and gas, I think people need to understand that that market is changing. It's going to change dramatically. And when you're thinking about, as a state, what you should be doing from an economic development standpoint and where you need to be putting your eggs, you've got to realize this.
This is Dave Jenkins, president of the Conservatives for Responsible Stewardship Group. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing with us.
Thank you for having me.
We appreciate it. And for KGNU, I'm Hanalee Myers.
This is the Friday Morning Magazine on 88.5 KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. Thank you for joining us here today. I've been your host, Shannon Young.